Are we that old that it was 20 years ago that your father taught? Oh. I'm depressed. I need a little more Grecian formula, I think. Someone yesterday told me that there's actually an outline in your binder, and which was kind of a surprise to me. This organization is much too efficient for me, because it must have been 6 months ago that they asked me to do this, and they wanted an outline for something I was going to talk about 6 months later. Well, I don't know what I'm going to talk about 2 days beforehand. So you do have this outline, and it's really quite a good outline. Did I give you this? Wow. It's pretty impressive. If you look at the top of this, this comes from my book, Thinking Straight in a Crooked World. Now, you're all involved in classical education, or at least associated with the ideals of classical education, and one of the things that you learn very, very early, at least what you teach your children to do very, very early, is to read. And since this comes out of my book, Thinking Straight in a Crooked World, I will just lay upon you the idea that everything that I was going to talk about in this outline 6 months ago is actually found in this book, Thinking Straight in a Crooked World. And we do have it for sale at our booth. But what I want to do this morning is, I will deal with this outline, so don't fret that I'm going to go off topic and all this. But one of the things I found in dealing with Christian worldview is, and a lot of the reasons why Christians get involved in Christian education, at whatever type it may be, is there is what I have called the Peking duck syndrome. And the Peking duck syndrome is simply this. If you want a tender duck for dinner, what they do to prepare this duck is they clip the wings, they tie the legs, and they tie the wings in. And all they do is feed the duck. And the purpose of feeding the duck that way and tying the wings of the duck and tying the legs of the duck, of course, is so it won't flap its wings and walk around and toughen its body. The only purpose for this duck is to be plucked, cooked, and eaten. And there are a lot of Christians who oftentimes see going into Christian education and doing all that we do with Christian education, and you know, keep in mind that this is where my heart is in the area of Christian education, that we tend to believe that that's the end all of what God has called us to do. So it's not enough to be classically educated, have a full knowledge of the Bible, and have an astute and honed ability to defend a Christian worldview against all comers. That's not enough. If that's all we're doing as Christians, involved in the development of our Christian worldview, we are going to lose in the end. Because you will find that opposing worldviews would like us just in that situation, cloistered with the knowledge that what we have is greater and better than anything anybody else has, but we have isolated that worldview within a very narrow academic and social and cultural setting. And while we become privately engaging, we end up being socially irrelevant. And again, opposing worldviews will be satisfied with that. As one commentator said, you can rant and rave about any ism you want on Sunday, but come Monday, the kids belong in school. Now, not in the kind of schools that you're talking about, but in their schools where 85 to 90% of children today are in fact going to school. Now, all these things are necessary. Knowledge of the Bible, being classically trained, being an astute apologist, being able to defend the faith, being able to rattle off historical facts and dealing with music and all of those things. Those things are necessary, good things in themselves and desirable pursuits in their own right, but they're not enough. We can be intellectually stuffed, but as soft practically and culturally as a Peking duck. And so my mission in life, and I do have one, and it's simply this. We have got to take and understand the Christian worldview in such a way that it is far greater than our ability to see how effectual that Christian worldview can be in the world. I mean, I envision a transformed world based upon the work that we're doing today. Now, if you don't believe that, if you don't think it's possible, and if you don't think you should be moving towards that goal, maybe not seeing it in this generation, but only seeing it maybe possibly in the next generation, or maybe even in the third generation, if you really don't capture that vision as to how comprehensive and how earth-shattering the Christian worldview is, you'll end up being a Peking duck. Let me give you an example of this. This is recent news. The Southern Poverty Law Center out of Montgomery, Alabama, been in existence for about 34 years and initially was involved in civil rights issues. And you may recall the Southern Poverty Law Center and Roy Moore. They were the ones instrumental in removing Roy Moore from office. The organization is run by Morris Dees. Just recently, in their latest Intelligence Report magazine, which goes out to law enforcement organizations, other civil rights organizations, it's a multi-million dollar cash cow is what it is. But this latest intelligence report is moving this organization in a different direction. While they were settled on civil rights issues, which was a very noble and important cause, they're running out of cases. I mean, this latest case, in fact, with this 80-year-old former Ku Klux Klan man who was finally indicted for the Mississippi burning case of these three young civil rights workers. He's 80 years old. They finally got this man. And this is where the Southern Poverty Law Center used to be. But now they're going after us. In this particular report, they're going after Christians. And understand this. They're going after Christians who believe in a worldview that has moral and practical consequences. That is a moral worldview that actually has some, not some, but in fact is involved in the world at large. And they will constitute you, they've already constituted me and other groups, Focus on the Family, Dr. D. James Kennedy's Coral Ridge Ministry, Alliance Defense Fund and the Blackstone Fellowship, you can go down the list, American Family Association. We are now considered hate groups because we believe in a moral worldview with moral absolutes that actually has something to say about the world in which we live. And because we hold to certain moral absolutes in the area of homosexuality and homosexual marriages and so forth, we become hate groups. So now anytime someone turns on the television and sees D. James Kennedy, or anybody who turns on the radio and sees James Dobson, or if anybody gets the American Family Association magazine, here's Tim Wildman on his daily radio broadcast, the people are going to think, these are hate groups. But see, this is what we've been working for all of our lives with our children, to teach them that the Bible has something to say about the world in which we live, and we aren't supposed to just sit on that knowledge, but we are actually to engage the world with that knowledge through persuasive speech and through performance in terms of godly action, and to attract the world to the ministry of Jesus Christ, to bring them under the umbrella of the gospel, to have them understand that the Bible applies to every facet of life. There has to be a transformation in every realm of society And now we have engaged the world on this because we have engaged ourselves on this, and we have taken this into the world in which we live, and there are people out there who say, what you're doing will be stopped. And we will be the ones to stop you. And so worldview thinking isn't a theoretical exercise, and it's certainly a necessary thing to do, but it's beyond theory at this point. We have to take practical action. Now, we don't take practical action in terms of swords and battlement and that sort of thing. We take practical action in simply applying the Bible to every sphere of life. And that's what a Christian worldview is. And I don't have to articulate all the basics of all that. You do know that. I mean, that's why you're here and doing all of this. But point three on your outline, notice what it says. Worldviews are comprehensive. And it's not just Christian worldviews that are comprehensive. Opposing worldviews are just as comprehensive. In fact, they're a leg up on us already. They understand, and as I'll hope to show you this morning, they understand the implications of a comprehensive worldview. They also understand point four, that worldviews are exclusive. They don't allow for competition. They will, in fact, compete against one another for exclusive intellectual domination over every fact. Just a couple of months, even before this, there was this whole thing about, you know, dominion theology, and everybody was a dominionist and so forth. And what do you think the liberals have been doing for the last 150 years? They dominate almost everything. It's only been really in the last 20 years that conservatives and, I mean, Christians, between 1925 and 1975, from the Scopes trial and from the candidacy of Jimmy Carter, Christians were out of the realm of politics and social issues forever. In fact, they were criticized for not being involved. Conservative Christians were criticized for not being involved. When the civil rights movement in the 50s and the 60s came up, the question was, where were the conservatives? And that was a legitimate concern. And so what happened? The conservatives actually got involved. But now that the conservatives are involved with a worldview that has absolute values attached to it, they want us to go back to the realm of between 1925 and 1975 because they don't like the competition. And I'll guarantee you they will pull out every stop to ensure that their worldview remains exclusive. And point five, worldviews are transformational. The other side understands that the way you capture a culture is by transforming individuals and then sending those individuals into every facet of society and bringing about a transformed culture based upon the new worldview. And now we're living under that transformed worldview. And now we are battling against that newly engaged transformed worldview. So, instead of being a Peking duck, what I want you to be is, I want you to think of this illustration. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the since you're, I'm not classically trained, so you're not going to find me use too many classical illustrations. Most of my stuff is pop culture. I'll try to keep that at a minimum. But, because I know you pay big bucks in order to train your kids classically, and I don't want to have to disturb that at all. But I'm going to go back. I guess you could consider this guy in the classical realm. It's about fifth century BC. His name was Milo, and Milo was a wrestler. And Milo was, in fact, in those particular days, you will find that to wrestle meant to wrestle to the death. You could go in. This was gladiator without the armament. And so Milo had to figure out a way how he was going to train himself in order to win. And so he took on a very, very interesting methodology. He would take a newborn calf, and he would pick up this newborn calf on his shoulders, and he would walk across the stadium, and then he would walk back across the stadium with his calf on his shoulders. And the next day he would take that same calf, he would lift this calf up, and he would walk across the stadium, and then he would walk back again. The next day he would do the same thing. Now, you know what was happening at this point. Every day the calf was getting a little bit bigger. And Milo was getting a little bit stronger. until the day came where he could pick up that full-grown calf, which is now a cow at this point, and pick it up on his shoulders and walk across the stadium and back again. This is no Peking duck. And this is what we're all about in the training of our worldview. We need to be in this Milo principle, is that we train ourselves, and put another little part to this. There's a tremendous fitness craze that's going on today. And when I was growing up, and some of you may remember this, I see some gray heads and some shiny heads out there, so we're about the same age. It was Charles Atlas, Jack LaLanne, Bob Hoffman, and Joe Weider. These were the guys who were involved in what then was called physical culture. And there was an entire culture related to this. And then it ended up breaking down into three categories. You had bodybuilding, weightlifting, and then weight training. And the bodybuilders, all they were concerned about was their body, just how good their body looked. That was it. They trained, got up on stage, did all their posing routines, but the only thing they really cared about was their body. And there was the other group who were the weightlifters. The weightlifters just cared about how much weight they lifted. They didn't care how they looked. Paul Anderson was a good representative of that type, the strongest man in the world, did a back lift with over 6,200 pounds. Didn't care how he looked. The object was to see how much weight you could lift. So on the one hand, you have the people who were just engaged in what their body looked like, and it was all for show. You have the other people who were strong, and they lifted just because to see how much weight they could lift. I remember in Columbus, Ohio, it had to be, I guess, 20-some years ago, where Valerie Alexeev was the first man to clean and jerk 500 pounds. And if you saw him walking down the street, he was a huge man, but he had a huge gut on him and so forth, but it didn't matter what he looked like, it was just how much he could lift. Then there are the weight trainers. The weight trainers are the ones who train in the art and science of weightlifting for a particular end, for a particular sport. So this is just a facilitator for a greater task. And that's what we have to do here. We have to understand that our task in developing a Christian worldview and making that Christian worldview instinctive in our children is a long-term strengthening task, so that when our children respond, it's not something they have to think about. It's direct and it's on the spot. The other side understands this, and we have got to understand it as well. Let me take you back a little bit tonight to the really right before World War II, and a man named Antonio Gramsci. How many of you have ever heard of Antonio Gramsci? How many of you have heard of Karl Marx, Lenin, Darwin? Okay. But hardly, there maybe 15 have heard of Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian communist. He was a communist that the communists didn't like. So there had to be something interesting about Antonio Gramsci. He died at 46 years old, tuberculosis. And his philosophy was this. You're not going to convert a culture through power and intimidation. There has to be a different way in order to bring about change in a society. You have to change people's perceptions about themselves and their world. Essentially, what you have to do is to create a brand new worldview that they will embrace willingly. And for this, he was put into jail because he broke with the Leninist, Stalinist way of handling the spread of communism. Like I said, he died at the age of 46 of tuberculosis after leaving prison, but he left behind a series of prison notebooks that described what it would take to destroy the Christian West. And that was his goal. He knew that if he got Christianity out of the way, you could bring in the new worldview of communism. And what he needed to do was undermine the notion of transcendence and to make this world and the things of this world absolute. He says, we've got to break the idea that there is something greater out there, greater than ourselves, and that we are bound to obey and bound to appeal to and make only this world the standard for everything. Now, if you say, boy, that sounds like today, you would be absolutely right. Because Gramsci's methodology was actually picked up by the secularists and the Marxists, and it was implemented in the world we have today. If Marxists are going to win, Gramsci argued, they must enter into every civil, cultural, and political activity in every nation, patiently leavening them all as thoroughly as yeast leavens bread. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's taken from the Bible. And yet Christians haven't abandoned that very idea. They think leavening the culture is an evil thing, that we shouldn't be involved in leavening the culture. I mean, the leaven is the leaven of the Pharisees and so forth. Well, the other side has picked up that biblical principle, which was a very good biblical principle, and have used it for their own end. To change the culture, Gramsci stated, would require a long march through the institutions, the arts, cinema, theater, schools, colleges, seminaries, newspapers, magazines, and the new electronic medium of the time, radio. Gramsci believed that if you're going to change a culture, you change everything that is produced within a culture and take over everything. And sure enough, it took place within that 1925 to 1975 window. While Christians were culturally absent, where Christians weren't developing a Christian worldview at all, you found that those with opposing worldview came in and began to transform society, and as we know it today, we've got it. And it took Carl Henry, The Uneasy Conscience of American Fundamentalism, back in 1948 to finally wake up Christians as to what was going on. But the church really wasn't listening. And so we have a tremendous battle ahead of us. And to give you the kind of the rundown on this and how this has shaped our society and how other people have in fact understood this, consider this. This is from William Shirer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which is a great book to read, and it is readable, although it's a big book. It'll give you a handle from an eyewitness account of what was taking place in Nazi Germany. In Mein Kampf, Hitler stressed the importance of winning over and then training the youth in the service of a new national state, Shirer writes. When an opponent declares, "I will not come over to your side," Hitler said in a speech on November 6, 1933, "I calmly say, your child belongs to us already. What are you? You will pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time, they will know nothing else but this new community." Now, on May 1, 1937, Hitler declared, "This new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education, its own upbringing." Hitler understood the way you break the back of the church and break the back of the family is to take the youth and educate them in a new way of looking at reality. Every person in the teaching profession, from kindergarten through the universities, was compelled to join the National Socialist Teachers League, which by law was held responsible for the execution of the ideological and political coordination of all the teachers in accordance with the National Socialist doctrine. The state was to be supported without reservation, and teachers took an oath to be loyal and obedient to Adolf Hitler. Neutrality was never an option for Hitler. It isn't an option for anybody, and it shouldn't be an option for us. There is no group of uninterpreted facts, uninterpreted reality out there. Everybody is looking at the same facts and the same reality, but they are giving their own interpretive analysis of them. Everybody's coming to the game with a different set of presuppositions, and they are taking away from the table the things that they can use for the transformation of society according to their worldview. And the question is, will we and our children and our children's children be involved in that transformational process? Or will we sit back and say, this is the enclave God has called me to. I don't want to do anything else because this is all that matters. The day may come when they come knocking at your door as well. In Germany, there was Nazi truth, a Nazi political truth, a Nazi economic truth, a Nazi social truth, a Nazi religious truth to which all institutions had to subscribe or be banished. Finally, Shirer writes, "We know now what Hitler envisioned for the German Christians, the utter suppression of their religion." Now, this same thing is happening today. And you saw, I don't know if you remember, there was a congressman, I believe, from I'm going to guess it was Indiana, who got up and talked about the demonizing of Christians. He goes in the spoke before Congress, one of the congressmen, and went and spoke, I think his name was Hostetler. And he was immediately attacked for even bringing up the notion that Christians are being assaulted in the world, in the United States today. Here, if you've read about what's happening at the Air Force Academy, Christian students in the Air Force Academy are being harassed because they're sharing their faith. Now, I don't know the whole story behind all that, but the report that's come out said, really, this is nothing unusual is taking place here, although we need to look into this. But it took one chaplain, and I have my suspicions about the chaplain, one chaplain to raise the flag about this. I mean, come on now. Every state university and every public school in the United States today excludes anything related to religion. I mean, we begged and begged for a moment of silence in the schools. Think of that. That's a victory for Christians. Give us a moment of silence in the schools. And they don't even let us have that. And so now we've got a group of Christians out at the Air Force Academy who are expressing their faith in Christ, and now they want to shut that off as well. And I thought these soldiers who are upset by this, I don't want them fighting for me. I mean, if they can't handle an exchange of ideas, an ideological exchange of ideas at the Air Force Academy, how in the world are they going to do on the battlefield? But this is what's happening all across the country today, is that Christianity is now the religion of hate, and it's the religion of, we're going to force this upon people and so forth. And again, we are in their sights. And then, you have the Islamic community. The Islamic community is essentially taking over Europe on demographics alone. In 30 years, some people are predicting that Europe could be almost fully Islamic. Islam is making a headway in South America, of all places, establishing, in fact, one article I have here, Muslims are planning global Islamic bank. See, they believe that Islam applies to every facet of society, and we're going to bring that about. Do Christians even think about banks run based on Christian principles? I mean, it would be so far out of the purview of most Christians that I think it would hurt them to think about it. There was an article written in Christianity Today back in 1990 called The Adult Gospel. It talked about how Islam really caters to adults. And I hope I'm not going to offend anybody here, but you would never see Islam portrayed as VeggieTales. You wouldn't see it. So we raise children on pablum, and we keep them on pablum, and is it any wonder when they go off to college that they give up this infantile faith? Islam comes along and says the Quran applies to every area of life, and it applies to economics, and they do a distorted view of it as well, just like the humanists do. The people say, yeah, that's why humanism is so successful. Humanism applies to every area of life. Christianity applies to what? Well, when you die, you're going to go to heaven. But what about right now? But when you die, you're going to go to heaven. Why do you think the Marxists were so successful in South and Central America? Because they gave them real life hope in this world. I mean, if you go back and you study the black Muslim movement, what was the difference? I mean, you had a lot. You had Malcolm Little, later to be known as Malcolm X. He was raised in the church. What was the difference? The difference, well, there were a couple of things that went on. Of course, the way that white churches responded to blacks, even black Christians. But one of the things was that Islam, the black Muslim variety of Islam, said that this applies to everything. It's not just when you die, it's that Islam applies to everything in the here and now. And that was attractive to them. Then there's Daniel Dennett. I don't know if you've seen this book. It's called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And he considers Darwinism a universal acid that eats through everything. It's like Alien. If you've ever seen the Alien movies, when you hit one of those aliens with a bullet, what happens? What drips out of it? It's not blood, it's acid. And it just eats through everything. And what Daniel Dennett is saying is that evolution eats through everything. Everything it touches, it consumes. It's comprehensive. And we will apply Darwin to everything. And this is why they're so opposed. They're just opposed to intelligent design. The idea that something, some force, some entity, some non-entity designed all of this. That frightens them. Because they know once the idea of transcendence gets into the argument, their worldview is finished. And there's John Dunphy, and you may have heard this quotation. He says, "I am convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity that recognizes the spark of what theologians call divinity in every human being. Their teachers must embody the same selfless dedication of the most rabid fundamentalist preacher, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanist values in whatever subject they teach, regardless of the educational level, preschool, daycare, or large state university. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new. The rotting corpse of Christianity, together with all its adjacent evils and misery, and the new faith of humanism, resplendent in its promise of a world in which the never-realized Christian ideal of love thy neighbor will finally be patient." He says, "I am convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity that recognizes the spark of what theologians call divinity in every human being. Their teachers must embody the same selfless dedication of the most rabid fundamentalist preacher, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanist values in whatever subject they teach, regardless of the educational level, preschool, daycare, or large state university. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new. The rotting corpse of Christianity, together with all its adjacent evils and misery, and the new faith of humanism, resplendent in its promise of a world in which the never realized Christian ideal of love thy neighbor will finally be achieved." This guy gets it. He understands. He understands. In fact, an interview done with him sometime later said, he said, "I agree with everything I said," and he says, "We're going to win." American Vision gets a number of nasty emails and voicemails from people. Comes with the job, I suspect. We got this one a few months ago. He says, I won't read all of it to you, but just some snippets from it. He says, "As a matter of fact, Christians have a back seat in America if you know anything about history. So get in the back seat, you weirdo, psycho Christians." Now, he's not just talking about me, he's talking about you too. If you read this stuff, if you have your children classically trained and you're teaching them a biblical worldview, you are a weirdo psycho Christian. That'd make a great t-shirt. Maybe we can make some money on that. "Get your stinking church Sunday stinking messages out of my country. You belong out of this country. You're the weirdos. You're the wackos. You religious people have some nerve pushing your God on me. Get your God out of my backyard." I don't know what he's doing in his backyard, but "get your God out of my house. As I mentioned to you before, you of all people should be in the back seat. You should be tortured for your religion. You should be prosecuted for your religion. Didn't we feed you people to the lions?" You can go on American Vision's website and you can listen to this yourself. I didn't make this up. And here's an email that was sent to WorldNet Daily, and it was called "We Are Going to Win." He says, "We are going to win. I will fight people like you until I die. I will give money. I will march. I will sue. I will never stop. Never. Every day I breathe will be to advance gay rights. Every success you people have only makes me more determined. And you people may get what you want for now, but young people don't feel the way you do and will be making the rules soon enough, and they don't hate gay people. It may take 10, 20, or 30 years, but gay people will get everything they want, I can assure you. All setbacks now are temporary, trust me. I live by this every day, and it is good news that God is on my side, the gay side." I want you to notice something about all of these. They're all really, really, really future-oriented. They're patient. And they work for something that is going to take place down the road. And they're working for it now. They're working for it every day. They're putting money into it. They're taking over all the institutions related to it. They understand what their worldview is all about. And the question is, will we as Christians get on the bandwagon? Now, they do have a dilemma. I've called this the humanist dilemma. And that is, when the secularist worldview becomes consistent with itself, it consumes itself. So not only are we fighting a battle against the humanistic worldview and opposing our worldview, but we have to live in the sludge of their refuse. That is, as they implement their worldview in society, not only just opposing our worldview, but imposing their worldview, and since their worldview is really is a base worldview, all of the cast-offs of that worldview end up falling on us as a society. And we saw this with the 18th century and the French Revolution. The French Revolution had high ideals. The French Revolution, as you remember, they thought they were going to create this utopian society, and the way they were going to create this utopian society was to get God out of the picture. That was the first step. They started a new calendar. They started with a new year one. If you study our Constitution, the Constitution of the United States, right above where George Washington signs his name, it says this was done in the year of our Lord. The French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the whole French revolutionary way of looking at things started their calendar with a brand new year one. If you wanted to do business with France, you had to have a kind of an intermediary calendar to tell you what day it was based upon what France was doing. If you want you need somebody to blame the decimal system on, it was France. They created the whole 10-base system for evaluating everything. They went from the creation week of 7 days to a 10-day week. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine, waiting for the weekend? I mean, working 8 days and then finally getting, the weekend? I mean, it was an impossible system and it didn't last very long. While our Declaration of Independence says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man listed what your rights were. And of course, whatever the state gives in terms of rights, the state can take away in terms of rights. We heard that just yesterday. Didn't they? What did the Supreme Court say yesterday? They can take your property away from you. Not just for public use and be compensated for it in terms of public use, as the Fifth Amendment says, but if they want, they need more tax revenue for your community. And there may be your family is just right in this great development area, and you're only paying a couple $1,000 a year in taxes, but if we build a big supermarket here and all these other stores and so forth, this will bring millions of dollars of tax revenue in the city, so we're going to take your property. 5 unelected members of the Supreme Court just turns around and turns the Constitution on its head. You see, once you take God out of the picture and standards out of the picture, everything is up for grabs. Anything goes. So much so during the French Revolution that they couldn't kill the people fast enough. They had to create a new way of execution. They had to create the guillotine. That's why it was created. It was just like, and the people, just like this, the people in the front rows weren't taking notes, they were knitting. The women were knitting as they watched one head fall after another. That's the humanist dilemma. When humanism works itself out consistently, not only does it affect the humanists, but it affects those people that the humanists affect, meaning us. And if you stand in their way, you're taken out of the way, one way or another. And I noticed, I said, well, this sounds awfully extreme. How can you say all this about America today? Because everybody says in America it can't happen here. And they probably said the same thing before Hitler rose to power. It can't happen here. And probably before the Tsar and his family said it couldn't happen here. And probably George III said, it can't happen here. And you go all the way back where everybody says it can't happen here. Well, it can happen here. And when you woke up on September 11, 2001, you said, it can't happen here. It did happen here. But the humanists have a problem. They have a huge problem. If you're a materialist, if you're a humanistic materialist, then the only thing that matters is matter. And that's not a very good position to be in. Nothing else matters but matter. And all this talk about libertarian ethics and so forth and so on, they don't have a leg to stand on. There's an article, it's called Unspeakable Ethics, Unnatural Law by Arthur Allen Leff. It was published in the Duke Law Journal, 1979. And this is a wonderful article, and it's wonderful in this sense. It's depressingly wonderful, but it's wonderful in this sense. This man understood the dilemma of his own humanistic worldview. The sad thing is he never saw he even saw what the answer was, but he wasn't willing to embrace it. This is how this article starts. Remember, this is dealing with the humanist dilemma. As much as they try to impose their worldview on other people and try to believe that their worldview is better than the Christian worldview, and we don't need the idea of transcendence, the idea that there's something greater than us out there, this particular article shows that it cannot last over time. He says, I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete, transcendent, and immanent set of propositions about right and wrong. He says, I want to believe that there are moral absolutes out there, transcendent. I also want to believe that those moral absolutes actually embrace our life in a close way that is their immanent. He says, I want to believe in findable rules that authoritatively and unambiguously direct us how to live righteously. He says, I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing, but rather that we are wholly free not only to choose for ourselves what we ought to do, but to decide for ourselves individually and as a species what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is simultaneously to be perfectly ruled and perfectly free. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to create it. So on the one hand, I want a law that says there are moral absolutes. And on the other hand, I want something that says there aren't any moral absolutes.